This is Will Friedle from Pod Meets World. Let's be honest. The 90s gave us some great things. The music, totally rad. The fashion, so fly. Home decor, that's a different story. In HGTV's new competitive series, Totally 90s House, two teams of iconic TV stars take on two homes frozen in time. Paired with HGTV experts, they'll turn dated spaces into fresh modern homes and compete for the ultimate bragging rights. Goodbye, honey oak cabinets. Hello, 21st century. Totally 90s House. Special series premiere starts August 26th at 9, 8 central on HGTV.
Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100-degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. As regular listeners know, mine also does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling filtered water. I truly love mine. Can't imagine not having it anymore. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. This week's Lovejoy Hour, I'm curious about whether the approval rating for the Misuse of Drugs Act is now on the wane. As regular listeners know, I've had my mind completely changed about drugs on this podcast, and I've recorded a few podcasts on the subject. We need drug reform. Having drugs illegal is just doesn't add up. The Misuse of Drugs Act is 50 years old, so I thought it was time to revisit it and see if we are moving in the right direction. Joining me to talk about it is Neil Woods, who's ex-drug squad and one of the leading voices for drug reform. Neil has written the books Good Cop, Bad War and Drug Wars, which I highly recommend you read. Seriously, read those books. It will change your mind about the way we perceive drugs in this country and the world. Let's meet him. Here's Neil Woods. Neil, welcome back to the podcast. Thank you for joining me. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing, Tim?
I'm really good, thank you. I'm really good. So it is 50 years of the Misuse of Drugs Act. So we'll discuss that. I suppose, first of all, we've got to say, how is the climate for drug prohibition at the moment? Are people positive towards it in the world? How are you finding it?
Well, I mean, it depends where you are in the world, because obviously different governments are at different stages of drug policy reform, depending where their politics is at. But I think the most important thing to remember about drug prohibition is that, you know, the fight to end it, the fight for drug law reform, is a social justice fight. And in that regard, it's very similar to social justice fights, such as the illegality of homosexuality, equal gender pay, civil rights movement in America. You know, whatever the social justice movement, it's like that. It's part of that series of society's development, so to speak. And as such, you know, it's very rare for any social justice issue to change through political leadership. It changes through social movement. And so it's the job of me and my organisation and all of our allies to try and get that social movement to grow quicker. And obviously, you know, we're more successful in some countries than others. So, you know, whereas they're making huge steps forward in Canada, not necessarily making huge steps here yet in the UK, but, you know, there's lots of the Baltic states are talking about decriminalisation, and, you know, there's various things going on around the world, even Mexico talking about decriminalisation and regulating cannabis. So, you know, there's always movement, but we've just got to keep pushing it.
Neil, people still think they think I've lost the plot when I say about drug reform and stop making drugs illegal. We've been so brainwashed for so many years. I'm on various WhatsApp groups, and one of them, which has got a lot of men on it, they're all constantly talking about alcohol and putting up pictures of pints when they're drinking, because they get allowed back in pubs and pub gardens and things. And yet, whenever I say I think there should be drug reform, they think I'm a lunatic. We've been so brainwashed. Do you ever get fed up with people thinking you're mental, you're mad, you're because you go down this path?
Well, I mean, yeah, and I agree with you. It is one of the most bizarre bits of hypocrisy when we talk about alcohol, which is actually proven to be more dangerous than almost all the drugs that are illegal. So yeah, but I mean, I've been sort of completely swallowed up by this world of drug law reform. It's been my full-time occupation now for the last 5 or more years. And, you know, 5 years ago, I was considered much more of a lunatic than I am now. The whole issue is now mainstream politics. Mm-hmm. You know, that things are changing. For this year, it is the 50-year anniversary. And with our allies, there's a lot of campaigning going on. And there are 50 parliamentarians, that symbolic 50, that have signed up to this campaign to repeal the Act. And that 50 parliamentarians is hosted by Transform Drug Policy Foundation. Now, 5 years ago, there was only really one outspoken MP who might have signed something like that. So the change, even though nothing is yet changing in policy, that's an enormous shift in just 5 years.
I suppose for anyone who's just tuned in, two things we need to do is, one, quickly explain your background. Three things. Two, just quickly recap on the main points of why we need drug reform. And three, I think we need to talk a bit more about the Misuse of Drugs Act and actually tell people what it is and why it needs to go. So let's start with you. Just give us a quick summary of you being an ex-drug squad and everything else.
Yeah, I'm a former police officer. I was in the police for 23 years, and over 13 of those, I worked undercover. So I used to essentially catch drug dealers for a living. It was my main, you know, reason to get up out of bed every day and chase drug dealers. But over the space of that time working undercover, eventually the penny dropped for me, and I realised that I was significantly causing more harm than good. I was causing great harm to vulnerable people who needed help, but also violence was increasing as a result of almost every operation that I did. You know, and all that policing does is make organised crime more powerful, makes our society more corrupt, and it endangers vulnerable people.
And I suppose one of the interesting things is everyone's been absolutely captivated by Line of Duty. And you actually lived that life, didn't you, really? You didn't know which cop was bent or which one was a good guy.
Yeah, exactly. And I just wish people realised just how well informed Line of Duty is. But in bearing that mind, you have to see that the kind of corruption that they talk about in Line of Duty, and that actually does happen, is only possible because of the value in the illicit drugs markets. No other kind of criminality can pay for that level of corruption. Let me just give you a procedural example that proves that level of corruption happens within drugs investigation. See, when I used to work for the organisation, the East Midlands Special Operations Unit, and I would be loaned to different police forces as a sort of undercover asset. Now, before I would get to those police forces, the team that had to be set up in a very systematic way, you know, there'd be an exhibits person, there'd be a techie, all the team that was set up beforehand would be given a lawful order by the senior investigating officer before I got there, that they were not allowed to know my real name, and they were not allowed to ask me where I was from or what my name was, and that they would be disciplined if they did. And that team would have to be completely cocooned away from normal policing. So they would be told that during the whole period of this operation, you will not talk to any other colleagues about this operation. Now, the reason that those safeguards were in place was because of the presence of corruption. And the fact that they do exist is proof in itself that the organisation knows about that corruption. But bear in mind, that's only for drugs investigations. It's not needed for anything else.
Mm, and that's because there's so much money and so much violence involved in drugs.
Yeah, exactly. And what policing has done over time is it has actually increased the level of corruption. Because say you take out a kingpin, someone who's in control of all of the heroin supply in one city, just half of that city, and the police celebrate it. They publish the photographs and tell everyone they've made a big arrest. The people who are most equipped to take up that opportunity, that gap in the market, is the person who controls the other half of the city. So what we do by policing drugs is we constantly grow those monopolies. And if you suddenly have twice the share of the market, you've got twice as much money to invest in corruption. And why would you not invest in corruption? Because that's the best way of staying three steps ahead of the law.
Do you know what's so interesting? I was on Sunday brunch the other day and we did a celebration of whiskey. And we were talking about the women's movement who forced prohibition in America. And they forced it because they thought their men were unruly and disrespectful and spending all the money on alcohol. 13 years later, the whole country was like, what the hell are we doing? We've just created more violence. We've created a worse environment for us all to grow up in. And so they got rid of prohibition. And I'm sitting on my show and it's so hard because I desperately, but you know, I'm not allowed to do this, but I'm desperately wanting to go, hold on, we're doing exactly the same thing with drugs, yet it's lasted 50, how many years now? Over 50 years. And we're still doing the same thing. What? Look at the lessons they learned there, but people cannot see it. And I just draw you to Keir Starmer the other day, which I found so frustrating because, you know, whatever you think of the Labour Party, he's the guy in charge at the moment. And he in the press the other day, he roared out the liberalisation of drug laws, stating he had seen too much damage, which is so contradictory in his past role as prosecutor. And his work, and he said his work would be on the wrong side. And then he said, when I was director of public prosecutions, I prosecuted many, many cases involving drugs and drug gangs and the criminality that sits behind. And it causes huge issues to vulnerable people across the country. I've never gone down that route. Now, sorry, I was just reading out the bit I was saying there. I think he's worried that his work will be on the wrong side of history, like your career was as a drug squad. And I think that is his problem with it, don't you?
That's actually a really good point. I hadn't quite seen it in exactly those terms, but perhaps you're right. You know, it's like a lot of senior cops. They don't want to admit that what they've been doing is causing harm. But I mean, and it's frustrating in terms of Labour because I took part in many of their events over the last couple of years led by the Labour Drug Policy Reform Group, in which they canvassed the membership. They held public events in order to have a membership informed drug policy. And that was presented at the conference. And it was, you know, it's voted on. So the membership wants drug policy reform. And some of the measures in that are looking towards a legally regulated cannabis market, heroin-assisted treatment, so the, you know, decriminalisation. There's lots of positive things in there. So, you know, the political movement within that party is actually wanting the leadership to do something different. And, you know, and actually all of the parties are starting to think in similar terms to one degree or another. But you raise a really another interesting point there, though, Tim, because quite often, you know, I speak to audiences all over the world. And sometimes if I get an audience where it was an audience of very doubtful people and the facts have won them over, quite often the question I get from the audience is, well, look, what you're saying is so logical and it's so clear that this policy has been a disaster. Why do our politicians not change policy now? Because the evidence is obvious. And that's an interesting and important question. And there's a few answers. You know, of course, the public has been brainwashed by the media. The public has been brainwashed by politicians. But I've actually got a fairly old-fashioned view of politicians in that they're generally good people who want to do the will of the people. And the problem is, this, as I've said, this is a social movement. But the social movement isn't growing fast enough. And that's because the narrative is controlled by the police. Now, if you were to consider international drug prohibition as a business, a business model, it would have the most powerful marketing strategy in the history of business. Because wherever you are in the world, whatever country it is, from Japan, China, USA, wherever you are, the police are constantly putting out three marketing images. But firstly, there's the image of the doors being smashed in by a battering ram or whatever. Then there's the row of mugshots of all the people who've been arrested in a gang. And third, probably the most important, is the images of the drug seizure, you know, the hay bale size block of cocaine or this or the enormous cannabis factory. Oh, it's always the biggest since the last one or until the next one. Yeah. And these three images are put out. They press released. They're put out in the news. They're put out in the newspapers and now increasingly on social media. And of course, the subtext, what this tells the public is that the current system is working. But the police within their own systems, within their own intelligence databases, know that it's not, that these activities are not reducing crime, and more often than not, they are increasing crime. So the public are being deceived on a massive scale. And we need to start challenging that police narrative that this is the biggest fake news going on anywhere.
Yeah, there was a report in Brazil the other day. They made news worldwide because they'd done a massive drug sting, and they'd killed 25 of the leading criminals in a shootout. And when I looked at that, all I could remember is hearing you say, well, that just creates more violence as they all now fight for that ground again.
Yeah, exactly that. My mind was woken up really when, after 7 months of an operation, almost getting myself killed, 96 people arrested, and all I did is interrupt the drug supply for 2 hours. And the reality is that made someone really, really happy, and it always makes someone happy. And there's an interesting use of language, actually, especially in the UK. Quite often, if you'll see in the news stories, a senior cop will say, we are committed to disrupting the activities of drugs organised crime, as if disruption is in itself a solution. Now, the use of that word is really fascinating, and I think that it has its origins in an army officer's training manual of how to deal with an insurgency. And you deal with an insurgency by disrupting their activities. And so the police are treating drug dealers in a community as an insurgency to disrupt the activities of, instead of a multiple billion pound marketplace, which they can't influence the demand of. And if you listen to business academics, they talk about disruption and in an entirely different way. They make the point that disruption is the secret. It's the path to market growth. If you can disrupt a marketplace, you create opportunities, you make the marketplace more dynamic, you make it more efficient, and you get market growth. So the police, senior police, use this word disruption without any irony at all, when they should be realising what they're doing is creating market growth. And that is what the 1971 Misuse of Drugs Act has been doing for 50 years.
I suppose we need to find out, how did it come into force in the first place?
Well, it was the end of a series of events where the United States of America has shaped world drug policy through a very aggressive foreign policy. They've used all their weight as this superpower to make sure that everyone followed their way of treating drugs. The 1971 Misuse of Drugs Act was the United Kingdom's concluding part of that, series of treaties and agreements. We had bits of drug laws before that. You know, we had some possession cannabis arrests, and we had the Amphetamines Act and the Dangerous Drugs Act in the 60s. But the 1971 Misuse of Drugs Act was bringing all of the drug laws together and turning it into a war chest of powers. And it even brought in this theoretical supply offence where police can make a judgment to charge somebody with possession with intent to supply. So you don't even have to have supplied. They just have to consider that you do intend to supply something. And so it really was a war chest of powers. And Section 23 of the Act gives the police incredible powers of stop and search in the street, incredible powers to go to the magistrate and smash someone's doors in the morning and search their house for the sin of having some substance in their house. It's an extraordinarily brutal piece of legislation which has completely shifted what policing actually is in this country, and similar legislation around the world has done the same everywhere.
Yeah, it was kind of a world thing, wasn't it? This rule, it came in, everybody adopted it, didn't they, in the world, pretty much.
Yeah, very much. I mean, wherever you are, really, the drugs acts are very, very similar because they are based on the requirements of the 1961 Single Convention on Narcotics, which was the United States bullying everyone, putting everyone into their place in terms of how they treat drug policy. And it was completely contrary to the British way of doing things, because in Britain, if someone had a problem with drugs up until the end of the 1960s, then they'd go to the doctor and the doctor would help them. It was a quite a civilized approach, really. You know, if someone had a problem with heroin, they were prescribed by the doctor. And only when we stopped doing that did we start to have a heroin problem.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing people don't realise. And when I do get into these conversations with people, I always say, Britain, we were very liberal with drugs and we treated people as the victim, not a criminal, and as a, you know, more of a patient. And when they hear that, they're shocked by it. And you can see their brains ticking, go, hold on a second, we were forced into this law. And I think that's a really important aspect that we should remember. Only, you know, 60 years ago, we were a good country when it came to being a drug addict. We would help you.
Yeah, exactly. Not only as a point of principle, or even pride in being British, you know, that we cared for people rather than judged them and criminalised them. Not only for the pride of it, but because there is incredible evidence that was the best way of doing things.
Yeah.
You know, and we should be following evidence for policy. It's not, I don't think that's too much to ask. You know, but at the time when America was trying to force the UK to adopt their policy in terms of heroin, they measured their heroin addicts in the hundreds of thousands, and we measured ours in the hundreds. So whose system was better?
Yeah, I know. And now what's frustrating is America is starting to relax their laws on things like psychedelics and obviously definitely cannabis. And yet we're still stuck with the old rules and laws. And doesn't seem that any politicians want to change that.
Well, yeah, that's true. But there are some very interesting things happening in the United Kingdom. Because if you look at Scotland, the drug death crisis has got so bad in Scotland that even politicians can't ignore it anymore. And because it's become a genuine political crisis, it's actually influencing politics in the way that it just hasn't at all south of the border. You know, if you were to ask people in England, you know, what are your top 20 political concerns, very few of them would write drug policy reform or drug policy issues in that top 20. In Scotland, it would be in your top 3 or 4 because the drug death crisis is touching so many people. And so you've got this situation where for the last 2 years now, just over 2 years, the SNP has had drug decriminalisation in their manifesto and various other drug reform policies. And you've got politicians of every colour talking about being progressive on drug policy. But the situation is that drug policy is not in the power of the Scottish Parliament to change.
Yeah, I think the problem is, though, I did some digging around and I ended up speaking to, a, I don't know what you call them, a lobbyist or a spin doctor, someone who works with governments, and they were heavily influential in getting gay marriage across the line. And I said to them, what's the appetite like for drug reform? He said, there is no appetite in English politicians because they don't gain anything from it. At the moment, the public is so far behind people like your way of thinking, the way that I think now after meeting you and reading your books. The public are so far behind. And also, he said, a lot of the politicians, they're terrified of their kids getting involved in skunk and all these, you know, major words. And that rhetoric, he says, that keeps coming back, which is if you tell the family that, you tell the families that, you know, that thing which we've had all through COVID as well. If anyone ever argues another side, you tell the families of the dead people that, you tell the families of the dead kids that, the one who took the ecstasy, you're the one who took the, you know, whatever it was. And that's always the argument against it, isn't it? That one family or that one person who died at a party. And the counter argument of it might be crap stuff they're taking, or, you know, or it could be an accident, things like that. It never adds up for them, does it?
No, that's true. But things are changing, though. And as I say, this is going to be down to the growth of social movements. And we just have to keep working hard at making that movement grow. But, you know, the Think of the Children argument is being reclaimed by us reformers. Because, you know, where they've regulated cannabis in America, in the USA and Canada, the evidence is clear that underage consumption of that drug has gone down because regulation works. Regulation does restrict child access to the drugs better than prohibition does. So, you know, the evidence is starting to come. But of course, it's the perception. Like you say, we have to win the hearts and minds. And one of the things I think that will increasingly be a political crisis that will bring about reform conversations is the issue of child exploitation, county lines. because there is now 50,000 children involved in county lines or similar child exploitation to sell heroin, primarily heroin and crack cocaine. Now, I know there was a BBC Panorama about this just last night, and it said nothing new, and it allowed the police to say that we are cracking down on this and reducing it. However, there is no evidence that the police have reduced any of it, and there is good evidence that it has stayed pretty constant and actually increased. You know, the elephant of the room in the room when you rescue, say you rescue 20 kids from a county lines operation, the elephant in the room is that the market forces mean that 20 more get corrupted into it, because children are such wonderful commodities for organised crime in that marketplace, because they are the perfect buffer zone between the police and the gangsters. So it's not going to end until we legally regulate those markets and take control away from organised crime. But of course, we have to have these conversations with the public. We have to explain to them that our children and everyone else's children are going to be significantly safer if we take control back, if we take control away from these gangsters. And that's the message we have to get out there. So we basically just have to keep finding the platform and getting that message out.
Well, I still feel really conscious about having this conversation with you now that people are going to be aggrieved by it. I'm a TV presenter on a Sunday morning TV show. I'm in entertainment. I don't mind doing it because I think it's an important message, but I still feel nervous about doing it because we've demonized that world so much, understandably, because you're not telling people to take drugs, and nor am I, but we're just saying the way it's operated at the moment is horrific and it needs a rethink. But it's a tough thing to talk about, isn't it?
It is a tough thing to think to talk about. I totally agree. But again, it's my organisation which is making it easier for people, because we're from the cops. We are people who've been on the front line of this war on drugs. And we're telling you it ain't working. And this is an interesting thing, actually, because there hasn't been as much political movement because of COVID, of course. But on the 26th of this month, I will be addressing many parliamentarians for an event for the all-party group on drug policy. And there are increasing numbers of politicians taking significant notice of us because we are police. And the movement, our movement, grows around the world. Now, an example of that, for example, is in Canada. Now, in Canada, they're not a member of my organisation, but they work closely with us, and they are part of the growing movement of police. And the Canadian chiefs, and I mean all of the Canadian chiefs, not just the organisation, but each one voted unanimously to take this decision. And the Canadian chiefs of police called upon, just last year, the Canadian government to decriminalise possession of all drugs. This is all the police chiefs calling on the government to do it. And this is an example of where us law enforcement people have had enough, and we are now standing up and taking a political stance. And another example is in Europe.
Are they going to do it?
Well, it's interesting because in the 12 months before that, Justin Trudeau said that his government had no intention of decriminalising possession. And his response to the chiefs was not so clear cut. He sort of suggested that it was under review. But, you know, the chiefs are still going to go public. They're still going to put the pressure on, and they will do until it changes.
Can I just say, right, I'm a criminal because I've taken drugs. And I imagine if you're listening to this, you're probably a criminal, okay, because of this act. I'm going to go through some of the drugs. Class A includes heroin, cocaine, crack, MDMA, ecstasy, LSD, DMT, psilocybin. And what's interesting about that, class B is ketamine, barbiturates, cannabis, codeine, things like that. And then class C is GHB, diazepam, and all those sort of things, and steroids. What's interesting is I put myself in a trial since I've seen you, Neil, of psilocybin at the Imperial College. I heard about this trial happening, and they wanted somebody who'd never taken psychedelics before, and that was me. So I said, can I do it? And they went, you sure? And I went, yeah, I'd love to do it. So I did it, and it's been an amazing experience for me, one I want to do a podcast about at some stage. Once they've released the once they've released all the data, then they'll do a podcast with me, they said. So I'm just waiting on that. It was a year ago, so these things take time. It took them 3 years to get the substance in the country. And so far, all the tests in America and UK, I wasn't tested on this particular subject. They just wanted to see how my brain changed and what happened. And I'll reveal that on a podcast one day, but something exciting did happen, positive, by the way. But they've tested on people with depression, and it's amazing results they've had for people, along with MDMA and LSD. And all these things are illegal. And you would get so much, you know, I mean, the prison sentences for what I did would be ridiculous. I would have had, what have I got? Class A, I didn't have possession, but I'd have had 6 months and a £5,000 fine, wouldn't I, if I'd got caught with that stuff. So, I mean, oh no, that's supply and possession. What did I have? I just had possession. I'd have had 7 years in prison for for taking psilocybin. I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It is absolutely ridiculous. I'm so glad you did that, by the way. Thank you for putting your head up and doing that, because it is going to be an incredibly important trial, and to have your profile as being involved in it is going to be fantastic. But yeah, it is ridiculous. And to quote David Nutt, he says that that our drug laws in terms of psychedelics has been the greatest censorship of science since Galileo.
Yeah.
Because it has prevented, it's 50 years of, just in the 60s when the science was incredibly groundbreaking and exciting, where they were starting to understand the causes of various mental health problems. And it was just switched off. It was just stopped for an ideological reason. And that is a terrible thing. And it's so good that now there's the beginnings of a psychedelic renaissance. But it does really highlight that our drug laws have just been based on ideology, and they are completely stupid.
Mm. Can I just say, I did it in a really controlled environment at the Imperial College. I don't recommend you go and take psilocybin unless you're around professionals who know what they're doing. It's only a positive experience for me, though, and I can't wait to discuss it on a podcast one day, because I think it's really exciting, and their findings have been amazing, which is great. I've heard some early findings from it, and I just think it's great. Another thing that I read in the news sort of today, I think it was, the police were shocked to find hidden in a wall was a machine gun and a load of ammunition to go in it as well, with a drug dealer's house they raided. I mean, the police shouldn't really be shocked. It's all in your book, your books, that this has happened. It's been happening for a long time that the drug dealers now have machine guns. So I assume that's licensed for the tabloids, just to make some sensationalist headlines. You expect to find machine guns these days, don't you?
Well, you do. Yeah, you do. And that's, again, since the Misuse of Drugs Act, you know, in Drug Wars, we explored how things have changed over time. And the truth of it is, with every passing year, organised crime are more likely to be using firearms to defend their territory or to try and acquire more. And that news story that you refer to, I think, also followed various journalistic analysis of the fact that the police are saying that this is an Albanian gang, and the NCA say that now Albanian gangs dominate much of the UK drug markets, apart from in Liverpool. Now, if that wasn't some open warfare about to happen, or an indication of it, I don't know what is, because, you know, gangs do fight each other over territory, and Albanians have been, I don't want to make this about any particular ethnicity or nationality. It could be anyone who could have dominated the trade. But the truth is, you can always expect more violence. And there's an interesting country which has been leading the way on gang violence in the last few years, and that's Sweden. Now, Sweden are fascinating because they are probably the most batshit crazy nation in terms of drug policy in Europe. They're obsessed with the ideology and believe that their current strict system is working. You can even be prosecuted from a blood test for possession in Sweden. Wow. which is incredibly oppressive and just horrific. And they have the biggest clampdowns, you know, the strictest police. And as a result, they have the worst violence in Europe. In Sweden, the drug gangs have moved on to using improvised explosive devices and grenades. And they are having hundreds of bombings in Sweden, like terrorist attacks. But it's drug gangs fighting over the right to supply the Baltic states, because the Swedish gangs have become the most dominant. They fight to supply drugs in Denmark, in Finland, and the other Baltic states. And they're having open warfare in Stockholm. And, you know, that's the result. You know, wherever you are in the world, I think it's reasonable to say that the more aggressive and strict the drug policy and punitive actions, the more violence you get from organised crime. And so what have we got to look forward to?
In some parts of the world, the organised crime actually runs the countries, doesn't it?
Well, yes, exactly. And I'm glad you raised that, because this is one of the things that we really need to be considering. Wherever you are in the world, at every level, as I've said, policing increases the likelihood of corruption because police take away the opposition and allow monopolies to form. Now, this works at every level, you know, street level, regional, national and international. And what this has helped form international cartels, which now control entire nations. So in particular, if you look at the nations in West Africa, Senegal, Guinea-Bissau, they are now narco states. They've been completely taken over. The cartels gave up on just corrupting officials like customs and local politicians. They just decided to take over the whole government. And it's now accepted by international police intelligence. They are run by cartels. And this is spreading. Now, there's an interesting report that came out just a few weeks ago by an organization called the Global Initiative. Now, the Global Initiative are the really clever people who are studying transnational organized crime. And this report that's just come out states that the growth of transnational organized crime is the biggest threat to international security and the fabric of democracy itself, alongside climate change. And they also make the point that combating climate change is also significantly a bigger challenge because of the growth of transnational organized crime. So, you know, when I read this report, it feels like it did decades ago when the people were beginning to talk about how dangerous climate change was. And it seems like, you know, we're going to have to steer this big oil tanker of policy bit by bit. And I just hope that people sit up and take notice of these dangers quickly, because things are not looking good. You know, the power of organized crime can reach a tipping point where it'll be very difficult to turn away from it. It'll be very difficult to claim back nations like Mexico, where if your relative is murdered in Mexico, you've got less than a 1% chance of justice from the state, probably because it's the police that have committed the murder. You know, these kind of situations are going to be very difficult to get back from. And I hope that people listening really sit up and take notice of this as a warning.
So is there a domino effect? If we make drugs, if we have drug reform and there's sort of a legal trade around the world, suddenly we start as a government or as a country, we start saying we're only going to deal with good guys. We're not dealing with the criminals. Will we see a change around the world where people go, oh, we have to legalize that? Say us in America and a few Europe decided to make it all so there's a legal trade in them. Would all those countries down in South America start going, we need to start looking like we're not criminals anymore, otherwise we're not going to get the trade?
Well, I mean, I'm not saying it's not complicated, because international drug prohibition is going to be very difficult to unpick. However, one of the great advantages in drug policy reform will be for social equity in those countries which have been most impacted by it, so the producer and the transit countries. Because, you know, international organized crime, drug cartels are not the best people to help equity and make sure that the wealth of drugs is shared out equally. You know, people are oppressed. And with good governance, this is something which can create a huge boost to the welfare and economies of places like Bolivia and Colombia, and significantly in Afghanistan, of course, because Afghanistan has an incredible wealth of drug policy assets in poppies, the ephedra plant, which could completely rebuild the country if you had the security in place. And you could take the money away from organized crime and even terrorists, insurgencies and various groups by actually taking the control of that plant away and controlling it by the state. So, you know, there are huge advantages for peace, security, social equity. But of course, you know, an international problem, the United Nations ain't going to solve this problem in a hurry, because my organization speaks each year at the United Nations Committee on Narcotic Drugs. You know, we make it known what our feelings are, but there isn't going to be much movement there. What we have to do is create almost a revolutionary shift in policy in each individual nation state. So we have to make it happen in our own nation. And that's where the domino effect will come, because, and it's happening already. It's happening already because lots of politicians around Europe are looking at the success in Canada. You know, the drop in crime, the drop in child consumption, the financial benefits of the legally regulated cannabis market. And, you know, there is a political awakening happening. We just got to keep pushing and make it happen quicker.
We still grow cannabis, but not allowed to take it over here legally. That's still the case, isn't it? We've still got farms in Kent and places like that behind barbed wire.
Yeah, we are still the biggest net exporter of medical cannabis in the world still. And British Sugar is one of those people that have licensed to grow it. GW Pharmaceuticals, as you say, in Kent. So it's extraordinary.
It's still illegal over here, yeah?
But it's still illegal. Well, medical cannabis is theoretically now legal, but we have this appalling, appalling situation where only rich people can afford it because the prescriptions are so expensive. Although, a shout out to Drug Science Project 2021, where they're trying to make it more affordable for people. But that's not enough. There needs to be political movement to make it free to those that need it.
I think we've also got to point out, and it was mentioned in your book, and ever since then I've read it, the media has a part to play in this. It's a really easy story, isn't it? In the 60s, the story was all the kids are taking LSD and they're going to, kill themselves and kill you and whatever else. There's always been these sort of stories. And there was a recent one not so long ago, I see you reacted to it on social media, where someone was talking about hippie crack, where they're inhaling the canisters which you use for cake making, I think, and I think helium, isn't it? And they were saying these will kill your kids, and it was another sort of sensationalist story which helps keep the drug laws secure.
Yeah, exactly. And irresponsible, cynical journalism has been one of the biggest contributing factors to this, to slowing down the social movement. Because, you know, for a long time, journalists just have thought, well, it's drugs, we can say what we want. It doesn't have to be based on evidence. Yeah, and this hippie crack thing, it's nitrous oxide, laughing gas, which has been used recreationally for a long time. And it's so rare to have any health problem with it. And if you take the right harm reduction advice, it's an incredibly safe thing to use, much safer than an array of other drugs. So, yeah, to demonize it in the way that the newspapers and online media does is so dangerous. It's so counterproductive because, you know, wherever governments clamp down on supply, they never reduce that supply. They just make the supply more dangerous. And we don't want to make any drug more dangerous for our young people.
Yeah, you always get this thing. I was talking to a politician about it online not so long ago, which I'm sure after I put this podcast out, it will happen again. And they always say, if you've seen what I've seen, you wouldn't take that point of view. And I always think, and I always point them to you, because I think you've seen more than most politicians have seen, because you've actually been in the drug squad, undercover cop.
Yeah, exactly. I'll throw that back at any politician. And let's talk about what we've seen then, shall we? Let's talk about the harms that's caused by the Misuse of Drugs Act 1971. Let's have a close look at the fact that ever since that act, drugs have become stronger, cheaper, more available and more varied. More young people are using them. And drug deaths are at a record high for the fifth year running. We've got fewer people in drug treatment. We've got bloodborne viruses on the rise again, particularly in Scotland. You know, the harms of drug policy are appalling. We've got young people traumatized by being criminalized and having their life chances affected by this ideological position. Look, as a cop, I've seen the most traumatized, the most vulnerable people in our society, people that we should be taking care of. I've seen the way that our society treats them, and it's brutal. It's piling trauma on top of trauma. And if, you know, any society should be judged by how well it takes care of its most vulnerable. And at the moment, We are found wanting. That much is clear, I think.
When you keep saying my organisation, you're talking about Leap UK, by the way.
Yeah, Leap UK, but not just Leap UK, because we are an international organisation. We are the Law Enforcement Action Partnership. I'm on the board for the organisation in the USA and also in Europe, where we're about to do a series of launch events across Europe. Now, this has been slowed down, like many things, by the pandemic, but we do have events planned in Brussels, Vienna, which we will do the concluding event in Vienna at the UNCND in next year, in just under 12 months' time. In the autumn, we will have an event in Copenhagen, Barcelona, Paris, probably another one in London as well, and maybe Edinburgh. But if anyone's listening from any other nation and you have the resources to help us put on an event in any other European city, Helsinki have invited us, but we need some more allies there, for example, then please get in touch. You know, we rely on the help of allies and supporters. But you know, momentum is growing. We will have senior police from right across Europe speaking at these events.
Seems to me, looking on, America seems to be in such a mess at the moment. Just everything. I mean, sadly, we're reflecting it a lot over here. We seem to be embracing their culture a lot over here. But it seems to me that a lot of it is connected with drugs. How is Leap USA dealing with this at the moment?
Well, Leap USA has been through a really interesting 12 months or so, because, you know, the second biggest news story after COVID in the last 12 months has been the Black Lives Matter movement, which, of course, has been gathering pace up and, you know, prior to that 12 months. But it's taken on a whole new dominance with the death of George Floyd. And in the USA, Leap are not just focused on drug policy like we are around the rest of the world. They have the luxury to also involve themselves in wider police and criminal justice reform. So their membership and the focus on them has grown extraordinarily in just over the last 12 months. It's incredible. You know, lots of new membership, lots of real fantastic exposure on all the major news sites and things. So it's good, you know, and they are literally steering the reform movement in the USA. And they have this system called a community responders model, which is a really good evidence-based approach to this problem of police murdering black people, essentially. But the focus of it always has to remain as drug policy, because the Black Lives Matter movement, not everyone realizes this, but it's essentially born from drug policy, because you look at all of these deaths, they're about drugs. You know, one of the cops who stood by laughing at George Floyd as he died, was he laughed and said, "Don't do drugs." You know, this is about a perceived prejudice, and the main mechanism of the oppression of people of color all around the world has been drug policy for a long time, and that's also the same in the UK.
What really worries me about the UK at the moment, Ross Kemp did this documentary not so long ago, and it was like, I didn't watch it actually, but I saw it at the Charles. It's about, should they arm the police over here now? And I'm like, whoa, hold on a second. So I know there are armed police, but they're like talking about arming all the police and getting more weapons in it. But they're having to do that, I assume, because the drug industry are being armed more. They're becoming more violent. So we're going to have to arm our police more and make up. Rather than reverse it, it's going the wrong way, isn't it?
Yeah, and that is a really good point, Tim. And people should really consider this, because, you know, most British people are proud of the fact that our police don't need to be armed. And less than 2% of police carry guns. So, and that is something to be proud of as a nation. But the one thing that has the chance of eroding that away is drug policy, because the only thing that is bringing drug violence to our streets, it's not terrorism, it's drug prohibition. It's the growth of drug gangs using weapons. And the increased monopolization, the dominance of Albanian gangs, and the potential face-off against traditional British gangs like in Liverpool, this just means more chance of firearms and more of a demand, need for British police to carry them. So you frame it perfectly right. Do we want to accept this, or do we want to challenge the causes and tell our politicians to stop it?
How do you feel at the moment? Do you feel frustrated, or do you feel positive we're going in the right direction?
Well, I'm a full-time activist, so I have to stay positive to keep going, really. So I'm optimistic, you know. The growth of political support and interest in drug policy reform in the UK and across Europe is fabulous. It is growing really rapidly, and eventually that will force changes within mainstream politics. But that's only as a result of the social movement. And so if anyone listening to this is finding themselves in agreement, or they've found themselves suddenly interested in this issue, then you are now part of the social movement. And so it's up to you as well. You know, it's all of our responsibility to keep us all talking about this, to persuade the undecided, to get other people to listen to this podcast, and for them to consider the issues as well. We all have a part to play in this. You know, see yourself as that flag waver and protester in the 1960s who were campaigning against the illegality of homosexuality, or campaigning to end the death penalty. This is the same thing. You can take this fight up. And that's what we need to do. We need to grow this movement. But there are some, you know, there are some tools to help you, though. Now, I mentioned earlier on about how police control the narrative. And together with Anyone's Child, which is another fantastic and very important organisation people should look up, together with Anyone's Child, at Leak Week UK, we made a little video. And it's quite cheeky, this video, because it's made to be used in response to police social media accounts where police have claimed success from a drug seizure. And so this video seeks to just briefly explain to people that this is a deception, that the police are actually telling you something that's not true here, because they've not reduced crime, they've increased it. And but the reason that we made this video, we made it as a tool for people to use, because almost everyone goes on social media. Everyone is seeing these posts from their local police. Post this video politely in the comments from the police social media accounts. Even if it's there already, put it there again, because the more that this message gets out there, the more it's causing conversations. And at Leap UK, we have heard from many sources that we have within the police that this video is provoking conversations exactly where we want it to be provoking conversations.
Do the police hate you?
Well, 6 years ago or so, I was public enemy number one to the covert policing world. And many people who work very hard in drugs investigations perhaps still feel that way towards me. But nowadays, and again, this is a sign of the changing signs, that I've been invited to speak to trainee police. I've spoken alongside senior police in the UK and around the world, and increasingly we have more allies than we do enemies. And you know that police are key to changing this policy, because we know the truth. And so I call on any colleague listening to this, you know the truth. And if you're honest and with the public, we can change things quicker.
And just a reminder, if you do want to get involved and you're listening to this, if you are a parent, as Neil's pointed out in this podcast in the past, it is easier for your kids to buy drugs than it is alcohol and cigarettes, because we've made it really hard for them to buy alcohol. They need to show up with some ID, whereas buying drugs, they can just go on the street and buy it. And the drugs, we don't know what the hell's in them too.
Yeah, that's an important point. And there's a growing, sadly, a growing list of members of Anyone's Child who are campaigning because of those reasons, because though there are so many parents in the organisation Anyone's Child who have found out the hard way of the truth of what you've just said, people like Anne-Marie Coburn, check out their videos on Anyone's Child. They're people who campaign because they've lost their children to drug policy, or their young people have been traumatised by being sent to prison because of drug policy.
Do you ever think you'll get to a stage where you can do a march? I mean, you talked about great civil rights movement in the past. They've usually had a march which encourages people to look into the matters and discuss them. Do you think you'll ever get to a stage where you can do that?
Yes, I think so. It's difficult at the moment to get mass involvement, but we do events like this. So, for example, in June, around June the 26th, we normally have a mass lobby of parliaments. So together with Anyone's Child and lots of other allied organisations, we turn up and demand to speak to our MPs, and we do a mass lobby, and then we do events in Parliament Green, and we have a big photo op with the increasing numbers of parliamentarians who support us. And we had them from every party supporting us the last time we did that. And it was a huge event. So, but, you know, these events will grow and grow. And, you know, another thing that people can do is we work with Anyone's Child to carry out local events. So, for example, we did a tour of West Wales just before the pandemic. Small towns in West Wales, we got all of the local councillors, the local mayor, all of the local, lots of local people to hear an event, you know, to hear Anyone's Child speak, to hear what someone from Leap speak. And suddenly the whole community is behind us. And explaining this to people community by community is a way of making that movement grow. So again, if anyone's listening, if you've got access to a village hall, if you've got a local politician or anyone who wants to get involved and host us, speak to us and we will put on an event for you. We will get the local press. We might even get the local regional television, local radio. We'll do an event for you.
And finally, Neil, the pushback I always get on it is if there's prohibition, if these drugs become legal and they're not illegal anymore, you will end up with kids just off their face on smack and crack all the time. You know, we're just creating a complete culture of zombies. Has that been the reality when people have looked at drug reform?
No, far from it. Quite the opposite, in fact. And this is an important point, that if people find themselves forming an opinion on drugs, they should ask themselves, where does that opinion come from? Is it what I've seen in the media, what the police have put out on social media, or is it based on evidence? We should base all of our opinions on policy on evidence. And the evidence is overwhelming that there are great benefits to society and individuals and for the protection of our children wherever there has been any kind of drug policy reform. So if you look at Portugal, for example, the numbers of overall drug users has not gone down. It stayed the same. However, the number of overall drug users is not the important number. The important number is the number of problematic users, people who have significant health problems with drugs. In Portugal, those numbers have dropped dramatically. So in other words, the Portuguese system of decriminalising drug possession has significantly helped the most vulnerable people in their society. In Canada and America, where they've legally regulated cannabis, child consumption has gone down, not up. In Switzerland, their crime has dropped by 50% because they prescribe heroin to people who use it problematically. They look after them with a private prescription from the government. And that has meant, actually, that the illicit market for heroin has shrunk and children are far less likely to get access to it. And the evidence is clear. There are no children dealing heroin in Switzerland like there are on the streets of our country. So let's go with the evidence.
What's Portugal's policy?
Portugal, they decriminalised possession of drugs. So possession of drugs is no longer a criminal offence. If you are caught with drugs, you are sent to what's called a dissuasion commission, where you will meet with a qualified drug worker to see if you have a problem and to see if you need any help. If you don't, you're very much left alone. And that has meant, because they saved so much money in the enforcement of drugs, they've been able to invest it in drug treatment services. So people are looked after rather than persecuted. Now, from my organisation's point of view, from a policing point of view, that's great because less people die. That's good. Less people have blood-borne viruses. That's good. But from a policing point of view, it's still organised crime that runs that business. And so there is still that corrupting influence in society and associated violence. So although Portugal has a far better policy than we do in the UK, we could do better. We could do better, and we have to strive to do better because we have to beat the power of organised crime before it goes too far, and that we can never bring it back.
Neil, always great to talk to you. We'll get together again in 6 months or so and have another chat and see where we're at, yeah?
Great. Good speaking. Good to see you.